Thanks. Appreciate it. Hey, everyone. Like you said, my name is Alan. I'm the CEO of TrackMaven. And I promise this is going to be the least salesy presentation you've ever seen. We're not going to talk about TrackMaven at all. So my background is right now I run a data company. Before this, I was CMO of a venture-backed startup. And so I think there's this really interesting tension in marketing right now. So we're at a conference, and I looked at the agenda. And we're talking about the art of marketing and the science of marketing. Those are the two big buckets that we're talking about all throughout the day. But what's interesting is, which is it more of, right? Is marketing really an art? Is it a science? When I was a CMO, I definitely say it's an art, right? It's about new and innovative ideas, bringing them to market. But now, as CEO of a data company, I see a tension, right? How much of marketing really is about data science, predictability, technology? And so I wanted to dive into this. And to dive into it, I really want to start by exploring the concept of creativity. What does creativity really mean? What does it mean in this new digital world that we live in? And creativity seems pretty simple, right? The dictionary definition is straightforward. It's the ability to make new things or think of a new idea. But what new things? What new ideas? What ability? I want that ability. That sounds pretty cool. And there's some people who seem just so darn good at it, right? There's the creative geniuses we think of, Mozart, Picasso, Taylor Swift, right? There's these people who seem so good at creativity. So what could we as marketers learn about creativity from studying those? So I got sort of obsessed with this question, and I started researching all these big creative geniuses and their creative processes and how they went about approaching it. And there's a few that struck out to me. So J.K. Rowling is definitely a creative genius, right? 7 books about witches and wizards that made her a billionaire. That's pretty cool. But when you ask her how she came up with the idea for Harry Potter, what she says is kind of crazy. She says, I really don't know where the idea came from. It came into my mind when I was on a train to London. Right? She had this light bulb moment, this flash of genius. One moment, she all of a sudden had this idea. And you hear this type of story repeated over and over again when you explore and study creative geniuses. Paul McCartney is the most prolific songwriter of all time. He has the most number one singles of any songwriter, even more than John Lennon. And he also wrote my favorite Beatles song, Yesterday. And when you look at how he wrote the song Yesterday, he talks about this in interviews, it wasn't some long, drawn-out songwriting process. It wasn't him, you know, trying things and using feedback groups. No, instead, one day he just woke up with it. He literally woke up with the melody for Yesterday fully formed in his head. He was, in fact, so worried that he had accidentally plagiarized it that he, for weeks, would go around just humming it to people and asking them, hey, have you ever heard this song before? And this is a little early in the morning for this, but I'm going to do it anyway. There's a side note on this. This is a true story. So he only had the melody that came to him, so he didn't have lyrics. So he used placeholder lyrics when he went and hummed this to people. And the placeholder lyrics he used, and I'll reenact this for you. This is true. Was scrambled eggs. Oh, my baby, how I love your eggs. Diddle, diddle, I believe in scrambled eggs. So thank you. Thank you. I know. American Idol. So what's the pattern here, right? What is the thing that we're seeing? Well, in all of these stories, there's a flash of genius, right? Because they start with infinite possibilities. There's all these characters and genres and things J.K. Rowling could write about. There's all these chord progressions and melodies that Paul McCartney could use. But there was all this stuff in one moment, whether it was they were on a train or in the shower or just woke up with it, one idea became suddenly clear. And this is how we try and do creativity in marketing. So the setting is a little different, right? Instead of a gloomy train on a London day, or instead of Paul McCartney's bedroom, looks something more like this, the corporate conference room. And our canvas is a little different, the corporate whiteboard. And I just wanted to reenact for you for a second what this actually looks like in most marketing teams. And you all have done this before, you've seen this, but I thought it'd be fun to reenact it. So there's a few different characters. I'm going to use 3 of them. And first there's Tony, the content writer. And he's responsible for actually creating the content, like probably many of us here. And he's going to this meeting to talk about, you know, what's the next campaign for us? What's our next big idea? And the CMO called the meeting. And Hillary's the CMO, and she looks over at Tony, she says, we need big ideas, big white paper ideas. And there's Will, the very agreeable middle manager and director of content. Tony, what ideas do you have? He's delegating. And
Tony sort of looks askew and says, oh, I have to think about this. And so he goes up to the whiteboard. And they're a financial services firm, so there's lots of stuff they could write about. There's taxes and college savings plans and 401ks. Wait, that's it. 401ks. That's a great idea. Tony sort of says it a shock. Hillary says, yes, great idea. Will, very agreeable, says, yes, great. And so Tony goes off to work. And so we all know what happens next, right? So we had this great brainstorming meeting. We came up with this idea. We're all like, wow, this feels really good. And so then what happens is we go off to our little bubble, and we write it out, and we get a designer and an editor. And since we're in financial services, there's like legal approvals. We're not sure why we really have to get legal approvals. And then it's finally done, and we're like uploading it to the CMS. But like no one knows why the CMS is so complicated. Like it's this whole thing. Then we finally publish the white paper. Then we're like, we're done. And then we're like, no, we're not. So then we have 6 months of actually getting people to download the white paper. We spend all this money. Please, please, please download my white paper. And then 12 months have gone by. And now Tony's at his desk, and he gets an email. Hillary wants a retrospective. He's like, I know what that means. So he goes back to the corporate conference room. And this time, Hillary's pissed. So only 105 people downloaded our white paper. Will's crying. We spent $10,000 promoting it. And Tony's in shock, right? What did I do wrong? We brainstormed, we collaborated, we had the whiteboard session, like we felt really good about it. So why did it not work, right? Is creativity something that only these geniuses can do? Is something we really can't do in a predictable way? And the issue is it's not just Tony. Most content today is failing. So the Content Marketing Institute does this study every year. And they're obviously like incented to say content marketing is pretty good, right? But in fact, the survey every year shows that it's not good. So they ask marketers, is your content effective? And 63% of B2C marketers and 61% of B2B marketers do not think their content is effective. That's crazy, right? Think about our industry for a second. What if like 61% of bankers didn't think they were good at banking, right? But that wouldn't be good. So how do creatives really do it? Because we try this all the time. We talk about innovation and collaboration and synergizing and all these buzzwords. It's not working. So how do creatives really do it? So I'm going to go to my next favorite example, Taylor Swift. I'm going to take a gulp of water for a second. So this is Taylor Swift in the Diet Coke ad. And in this ad, you've probably all seen it, played like a million times, she's writing the song 22, which was a big smash single. And she's strumming out each chord. She's humming it to herself. She's scratching out the lyrics in her diary, putting it together. Like, the song's just coming to her. It's this sort of, like, religious moment. And it seems to work pretty well for her. So a couple years ago, she released 1989, her last album. It sold 8.6 million albums. I listened to it, like, a million times. It had 3 number one singles. That's pretty crazy. Shake It Off, Blank Space, Bad Blood. It was a huge creative success. And you think about Taylor Swift, and you think about her just backstage writing those songs, it seems so easy, right? How does she do it? But then you take a closer look. And so then I went and looked at the liner notes of her CD, or more likely for all of you, Wikipedia, if we're being real. And what I found was kind of interesting. So Shake It Off was co-written by someone named Max Martin Shellback. Blank Space was co-written by Max Martin Shellback. Bad Blood was co-written by Max Martin Shellback. Who the heck is Max Martin? Who named their child Shellback? Well, it turns out they're Scandinavian hit doctors. In fact, Max Martin's with NPR called the Scandinavian secret behind all of your favorite songs. He's the ringleader of this entire movement of pop songwriting. He trains these people. Shellback actually works in the studio. He trains them on his formula of how to write pop songs. And there's a whole group of people who either work for him or trained by him or trained by someone who's trained by him. There's this whole sort of mafia around Max Martin. And here's a crazy stat. You ready for this? In 2014 and 2015, 40% of all number one singles were written or produced by Max Martin, someone who worked for him, or someone who was trained by him. That's crazy. Crazy. One group of people control 40% of the hit pop songs. That's not just a flash of genius. That's not just sudden brilliance. That's something different. Scott Porchetta is the CEO of Big Machine Label Group, which is Taylor Swift's record label. And he's the one who actually introduced Max Martin to Taylor Swift. And what he said I thought was almost poetic. He said, I encourage our artists to dig deep and always do their best work, but if one of them gets stuck creatively, we tear it down and rebuild it in their own image. That's pretty intense. And here, by the way, is Max Martin and Shellbeck celebrating the album. Max Martin is not ironically in a Genius sweatshirt. I did not Photoshop that. This stuff's real. And so this is pretty interesting, right? Because this is not how we think about creativity. And Arthur Borjon is a songwriter who's part of the Max Martin Mafia. He's written hit songs for Janet Jackson, Celine Dion, Santana. And he was asked at a conference, much like this, on what makes a good pop song, right? What's the formula? And I thought his answer was really telling.
Not that it's all about pop, but to you, what makes a hit song?
Well, to me, there are a few different ways to look at it. I worked with Max Martin for 5 years, and it was funny, he has his formula of going, never use more than 3 melodic parts in the song. If it's more than 3 melodic parts, the song is not good, which means you have to fix it with. So 3 parts.
So verse, chorus, bridge sort of
thing. Yeah, and recycle parts of the verse or part of the song in the chorus. So when the chorus comes, you already heard the chorus, but it's in the beginning of the verse. That's actually Dennis Pop's formula that Max Martin took, and we all went like, you need to minimize the information for the listener.
And what's amazing, it's not even just melodies. Bonnie McKee is a lyricist who worked for Max Martin. She's written the lyrics to such literary greats such as California Girls by Katy Perry and Dynamite by Tal Cruz. And she was asked in a New Yorker interview, how does Max Martin think about lyrics? And she said, it's very mathematical. A line has to have a certain number of syllables, and the next line has to be its mirror image. There's a science, there's a formula for how these pop songs are written. That's why 40% of all the hit songs were written by one group of people. So the things we often perceive as creative brilliance on the surface are actually often the product of a system. And this is a theme that I want to hit on during our presentation today. So, and there's some businesses which realize this. Netflix is a great example. So Netflix has sort of reached the pinnacle of startup success. They have over 65 million subscribers, and they now have a $50 billion market cap. It even feels weird to call them a startup anymore. And there's one guy at Netflix who I think has a particularly difficult job. And it's not the CEO. It's this guy, Ted Sarandos. He's the chief content officer at Netflix. He's in charge of all licensing, all acquisition, all new content production. Anything you watch on Netflix, his team has bought and paid for. And the reason why this job is hard is that according to IMDb, there's over 3.4 million movies and TV episodes. So what do you pick, right? How do you even know what you should be buying? And there's a particularly hard problem when Netflix launches in a new market. So they recently launched in France. And how does Netflix know what French people like, right? How do they know what content to start with? There's 3.4 million options of things that they could license for that audience. So Ted was at a, first name basis, Ted. Ted was at a conference and was asked this question. I wanted you all to listen to his answer.
At launch, whenever we launch a new territory, where we launch with is about half of the programming that that territory will have in about 12 months. So, and we are literally adding programming every day to the new territories. And we launch deliberately without everything, because every single day that we're there, we know more and more about French viewing behavior, what people really want to see. So what you see at our launch is what we have a pretty good handle on the market based on everything you can know without operating there. And then every day we get more and more viewing behavior. We license the content that people more and more want to see. So the programming from after the launch in the first 12 months mostly reflects that market's viewing behavior. So it is an intentional launch with less content than you'll have 12 months from now. In every market, it's more than doubles over the 12-month period of the first 12 months.
So Netflix is using data to make these huge content decisions. And it's not just for licensing content. It's actually for new original programming, too. So I'm from Washington, D.C., and so House of Cards is a big thing in my life. Fun fact about House of Cards is actually shot in Baltimore, so like I don't recognize any of the buildings in there other than the Capitol. And the story of House of Cards is really interesting. And the reason we know a lot about it is because obviously it was a big success. And so when people are successful, they like to do lots of interviews about why they're so smart. And so the producers of House of Cards have given all these interviews about the origination process and why Netflix bought it and all this stuff. And what's really interesting is how Ted Sarandos' team approached it. So when they were first pitched the show, there was three main characteristics. It was directed by David Fincher, who's the guy behind Fight Club and Seven and Social Network. It was a political thriller, and Kevin Spacey was the lead actor. And so what did they do? Well, they're like most movie studios or most TV houses. They would sort of talk about it and think about it and look at, you know, who are the showrunners. But they said, no, let's go and look at the data. This is their first bit of original programming. And so Netflix has two pieces of data that they look at. One is what they call starts, which is exactly what it sounds like. How many people started watching a movie, and then completes. How many people watch it all the way through, right? Because you start watching something and you don't like it, like that's a pretty good signal of intent. And for all three of these categories, you know, Kevin Spacey movies that were on Netflix, political thrillers that were TV shows or movies, the data was off the charts. People love Kevin Spacey. People love political thrillers. People love David Fincher movies. So what did Netflix do? They said, okay, we're going to give you $100 million to buy two seasons up front. And this is insane. Usually when you buy a TV show, you buy one season up front because if it doesn't work, you cancel it. Pretty practical, right? So the producer said something along the lines of, sure, that sounds great. And we all know what happened next. House of Cards was released, and it was a huge success. Netflix got over 2 million new subscribers, and 86% of Netflix subscribers who watched House of Cards said it made them less likely to cancel their Netflix subscription. They got ROI. And so what Netflix has done is they have turned data into their business model. It is how they make the most important decisions about their business is all using data. And there's actually a recent example of this that I thought it would be fun to throw in, just because I thought it was such a good example of this. So they announced this deal with Adam Sandler, which to me is crazy because like it's Adam Sandler. And like, have you seen Spanglish? And and they said they're going to produce his next four movies for $250 million. And that's insane, right? That's a huge amount of money. And again, he's a Spanglish guy. And so like, why is this, right? So Ted Sarandos was interviewed about this. And again, it all came back to the data. It turns out Adam Sandler is huge in international audiences. People love him in Asia, Latin America, Europe. I think it's because they haven't seen Spanglish. And he's also huge for online streaming. People like, if they're sick, like they'll actually sit there and just watch Adam Sandler movies. It's a good thing to be sick to. You have to be sick to like this stuff. So the question I sort of had after reading about all this is, so is it just Skynet, right? Or is this just a data? Are the machines taking over? Are all of our jobs gone? And Ted Sarandos was asked this at a conference, and he said, no. In practice, it's a 70-30 mix. 70% of the decisions we make are based on data, and 30% of the decision is judgment. But that's kind of crazy. When was the last time you made a decision that was 70% based on data? Think about it. Netflix is making decisions in the hundreds of millions of dollars that are majority based on data. That's crazy. So this is what I call the concept of intentional creativity. And it's about using data to reduce options, and we'll talk about what that means in a second, to ones that have a high probability of success. And this is the opposite of marketing creativity. This is the opposite of the flash of genius model of creativity, which you just do things over and over again and we hope things will work. Intentional creativity is different, but it starts with the same first step. So of course, there's still infinite possibilities, right? Netflix could license 3.4 million different movies or TV episodes. We could create a tweet about anything. Right? We could write a novel about anything. There's infinite possibilities of things we could do. But here's where it's different. Instead of waiting, hoping, thinking about what our next thing's going to be, we use data to actually reduce bad ideas, to actually take away all the things that we know won't work, to actually come up with just a few finite options that have a high probability of success. Then we use us, people, to make that next leap. So instead of our job being to wait and hope for one idea to suddenly become clear, our goal is to take a few ideas that we know have a good degree of success and use intuition and judgment to make that final call. And then finally, it's all about iteration, right? So measuring the results like Netflix did and seeing, were these the right metrics to measure, right? If House of Cards was a flop, We know, hey, starts and completes might not be the right data to actually look at. They might not be the thing that we should be using. So it's about constantly iterating your model of intentional creativity. So it's not about hitting your head against the wall. It's about adopting a system. And when you start looking, you can find this across many different types of businesses. So Starbucks is a great example. I got my triple venti frappuccino today, which we shouldn't talk about. And there's a lot of places where I can get that. There's 20,000 Starbuckses worldwide. There's 11,000 in the United States. There are literally Starbuckses across the street from each other. That is not a myth. This is a picture of one of the ones in Houston. As Chad Shanks on Twitter called it, a Houston landmark, the Starbucks across the street from a Starbucks. I couldn't find a photo of it, but there's actually also another corner in Texas. I don't know why these are all in Texas, where there are three on one corner, which is, I don't know, like that's like a pinnacle. So, you know, this seems really haphazard, right? They're just placing Starbuckses. But of course, at this point, you know what I'm going to say is, no, they had a formula. And Lisa Kearns is the director of international store development at Starbucks. She's in charge of placing Starbuckses. And what they found when they first started growing their business was that there were four key things for what made a successful Starbucks. There had to be at least 25,000 people nearby. The median household income had to be $40,000 a year or more. 60% of the adult population had to have some college education. There had to be a certain amount of sort of like young adults. And the issue was that when they started, this was a correlation. They realized their stores that worked, it had this. But then as they wanted to start to scale really rapidly, well, how do you find these places, right? How do you do this at scale? And so they've actually automated their data collection. They actually launched a product called Atlas, which is this crazy mapping application that brings in all the data you could ever possibly want. So trade areas, retail clusters, demographics, transportation, you know, where new construction is going to be. And they were at a conference, a geospatial conference, which sounds really cool. And they actually gave a demo of what the software looked like. I wanted you all to see it.
700 plus partners, what we at Starbucks call employees, in 15 countries start their new store journey in Atlas, our market planning and business intelligence system. What you see in front of you is Atlas for mainland China, where we currently have 1,200 stores and are now opening a new store almost every year. Sorry, every day. One of the key differentiators is how we resonate with our local community. Because of this, new store decisions are made by local partners in the field. Let's go to one of these local markets, a tiny market, population 2 million in Nanning, Guangxi, where we have 8 locations but are growing fast. One of our local partners in the field, Penny Chen, works and makes decisions around new stores in Nanning. Penny can't do her job without Atlas. Here are some of the many layers that are integral to her decision-making around new stores. Things like trade areas, retail clusters and generators, traffic and transportation nodes, and demographics. After analyzing a new market and neighborhood, Penny utilizes Atlas to pinpoint new store decisions. For instance, in this part of Nanning, 3 new office towers will be completed over the next 2 months. After adding a new target area, Penny has provided a workflow window which helps her progress the site through approval, permitting, construction, and eventually opening. This is how we start with the idea of a new store and bring it all the way through to the cutting of the green ribbon.
And the line that I thought was really important from this whole video was one line. Penny can't do her job without Atlas. Right? It's not about the machine by itself. It's not about Penny by itself. It's about bringing human judgment and data and systems together. That's where their success comes from. And it worked. During their big growth, they went from 116 stores in 1992 to 15,000 in 2007. And their share price at the same time grew 3,000%. So what about marketers, right? How do we apply this to our jobs? How do we think about this? Well, there's a bunch of fun case studies. I wanted to pick one that's not a TrackMaven customer. And so MasterCard, I thought, was a really fun example of this. So MasterCard has what they call the Social Command Center, which, by the way, sounds awesome. So the Social Command Center is in their headquarters. And basically what it is every social analytics tool imaginable that you could want all in one place. And they have a full-time team that their whole job is basically doing ongoing reporting for the marketing team, for the executive team, but also ad hoc projects. So If you're on the MasterCard marketing team and you have a question about something you're working on, you can ask them to help you with it. And one of the teams that asked them to help research was the MasterPass team. So MasterPass is MasterCard's mobile wallet solution. It's, you know, competing with Google Wallet and Apple Pay and all these different products. And they were launching kind of late to the market, and they wanted to understand, okay, how do we differentiate ourselves? How do we get heard in such a crowded space? You know, a question that a lot of us always have. And so what the Social Command Center team did is they went and they analyzed 85,000 conversations on other mobile payment solutions. All of the launch press, all of the Twitter chatter, all this stuff. They looked at all of it. And what they found was that there was four key frustrations that people had. And it was split between adopters and non-adopters. So people that actually adopted the technology were frustrated that there wasn't enough point of sale acceptance and there wasn't good customer support. People who were non-adopters complained about security. They were worried, like, is this safe? I have my credit cards on my phone. Can someone just walk by me and steal them? And there's too many options for setup, right? It was just complicated. It was a whole mess. And so this is what the MasterPass team did. They said, okay, you know, we have literally infinite things we could launch with, infinite angles, right? Our design's pretty. We have all these different things that we could focus on. But what we're going to do instead is we're going to focus on this really simple problem. It's messy, right? And we know that because customers are worried about that. They're saying, hey, it's just too complex for us. So they actually launched with their whole entire pitch being, hey, we're the simple, we're the straightforward mobile payment solution. And it worked. They had this huge avalanche of PR from it that all of us would be envious of. And you know, we've launched products before, all of us here. It's like terrifying to get someone to actually write about it. And they got all this press. Read Write actually wrote, MasterCard's MasterPass aims to sidestep the mobile payment mess. Right? They had hit a nerve with their audience. They had resonated with their buyers. Because what they did is they followed the steps of intentional creativity. Right? There was infinite things they could have written about. There was infinite angles they could have taken. But instead, they used data to actually reduce options, to focus, to actually say, what are the things we should be writing about, we should be launching with? Then they used their team to actually package that and curate it. Then ultimately, the results spoke for themselves. So for MasterCard, like Taylor Swift, creative brilliance wasn't a flash of genius. And so I want to leave you guys with four thoughts. One is that most marketers create content waiting for flashes of genius, waiting for Tony's great idea. The second thing is most marketing is failing. And if we're really honest with each other, we know this, right? We look at our Twitter feeds and we're like, oh, wow, no one responded to half my content, right? So over 60% of B2B and B2C content is not effective. You too can be Taylor Swift. So you too can build a process. You too can use a system. You too can actually adopt this stuff. And the last point I want to say is that it's all about success comes from the combination of data and people. It's not one or the other. It's not art or science. It's art and science. Thank you so much.
Alan, thank you. We've got time for Q&A. So since I think everybody by now knows the drill, I'm on this side of the room. So if there's a question over here, we'll start over here. And if not, I'm willing to make the run all the way across to the other side. Anybody want to open it up? Okay, then I'll open it up, Alan. So Alan, what are you seeing? And I know I appreciate and respect the fact that you don't want to sell TrackMaven. That's cool. But you are in a unique position because you see a lot of companies that are using data very aggressively. What are you seeing in terms of the learning curve? You know, that Netflix example of 70% of their decisions are based on data, 30% based on human judgment. That was the point that resonated most with me. So what are you seeing there's not a lot of Netflixes out there, right? What's that learning curve look like?
Yeah, totally. So for the learning curve, we like to talk about, there's sort of four steps in marketing evolution. So there's gut-driven, which a lot of us are. There's data-aware, so we know what the data is. And then there's data-informed, so we're starting to make decisions based on data. We're doing more reporting. And then there's data-driven, where all of our decisions, the majority of our decisions are made on data. So we think about sort of the evolution on those four steps. I think if you look at most marketing teams, you can probably pretty self-critically say sort of where you are in that evolution. And I think the thing that most people don't realize is you don't actually need that much technology and tools to go all the way up the curve. Like, there's so much free data out there, data that you already have. Like, if you're doing customer surveys, if you're a consumer brand, for example, you actually already have a pretty rich set of data about what does my audience look like? What are the demographics, right? If we know 65% of my audience is females in a certain age bracket, that can actually pretty well inform the content we're creating, what events they're going to care about. And so I think the sort of misconception that people have is that it's a budget thing or it's a tools thing. I think it's really a process and method thing. So it's all about, what does our editorial planning look like, right? Is it us sitting around a conference room brainstorming, or is it coming with the data we have, even if it's not as complete as we'd want, and making decisions based off that? And so I think it's not actually a tools or technology problem. I think it's typically a process problem.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Okay. All right, we're going to start here because it's easiest, and then I'm going to come down to you.
In this process to evolve through this system and get data-driven, how do you drop the silos and bring in like your engineering team and your products and residential sales people, and like where do you start bringing those people in on that process, because we all have different focus points.
Totally. And this is one area I think is really exciting for marketers. I think marketers are at a crossroads in just our industry where we have a lot of opportunity internally to be the champions for data-driven business practices more broadly. And so I think to your question, like, yeah, there are a lot of engineering and product teams and sales teams that aren't data-driven enough. And so I think one thing that's cool is that this is actually a pretty repeatable way for marketers to increase their own effectiveness and success. And so what I've seen that's really neat is a lot of marketers have become internal thought leaders, influencers within their companies, because they actually become data-driven and they see really big success from it. So I think it's a great way to basically show and become an internal champion for being data-driven. And I think what you'll see is that a lot of teams internally will say, oh, wow, like, marketing did that, it's working, it's interesting, they'll respect you and listen to you more. And I also think what's cool about sort of trying to become data-driven as a marketer is that inherently you can prove its own effectiveness, right? If you're measuring all the data, you sort of within that box are able to say, look, it worked.
Hi. Since TrackMaven is a competitive tool, do you have any opinions or thoughts on how much you should be looking at your competitors? Because I know we use a lot of stuff based on what we've succeeded with so far. And we don't want to get to the point where we're trying to chase, like, you know, viral videos.
Yeah.
But where's that middle ground? Do you guys have maybe a formula for figuring out how much you should be looking at it?
Yeah, great question. So for us, we typically talk about you want to be looking at people who are your competitors for attention, not necessarily your competitors straightforward. So what I mean by that is, if you're a consumer brand, I don't want you just looking at the other people who are on the shelf next to you. I want you also looking at NPR and maybe BuzzFeed, depending on your audience, and the New York Times, and getting an understanding of what is my audience looking at right now, what are they interested, what's top of mind for them, and really starting to get a sense of sort of like their interest and their taste. And so I actually don't think it's about necessarily just competitors in the sort of traditional sense. I think it's much more about competitors for time and attention, because right now that's the most valuable asset that most of our audiences are giving up.
So I work for a medical device company. We haven't done a whole lot of social presence. We've asked for some money this year to invest in that. President of our company wants to understand what the return in sales is as we're investing in a social presence. Do you have any best practice tips, suggestions for us to look at as we're investing in this platform, and how we can relate that to sales?
Yeah, so I think it really depends on your sales model, right? So if you're an e-commerce solution, it's pretty easy using UTM codes to sort of build an attribution model for this stuff back. I assume the devices you're selling are relatively expensive, so it's harder, right? And so I think that's where you probably need to go a little bit higher up the funnel. And you also might want to think about researching account-based marketing. And so there's a lot of interesting stuff going on right now, the sort of crossroads of account-based marketing and social. So if there are, I don't know enough about your business, right, but if there are 1,000 doctors or 1,000 hospitals that are super relevant for you, it's actually not that difficult to measure how often are you touching or influencing those people on social. And there's a lot of tools and technology. We don't do this, but there's a lot of tools and technology out there that would enable you to do that. So I'd really think about sort of mixing together account-based marketing and social. And you probably won't be able to go all the way down the funnel of being able to say, hey, this $20,000 medical device was purchased because someone read a tweet. But you can start to measure how many times on social are we interacting with either these, you know, hospital systems or people who work there.
Okay, we still have time, so I'm going to ask another. So in my opening remarks, Alan, I talked about the trends that we're seeing in the CMO and how they're hiring data scientists. So can you remark on the types of roles that you see that you're seeing in the marketing organization in terms of getting their arms around data for decision making?
Yeah, great question. So I think if you're a marketer right now and you are trying to think about your career, the number one thing you should do is you should go to a local college and be taking stats classes, like 100%. And I know that sounds kind of silly, but really the marketers we're seeing that are getting promoted, especially a lot of these high growth companies, are the ones who really have a good fundamental understanding of data, how to communicate about it. There's a lot of programs. There's a few in Chicago. I was talking to someone yesterday about this. There's a few in Chicago that also teach about web analytics and just thinking about segmentation and segments and how to measure different attribution models. And so I think the biggest thing anyone can do in this room right now for their career is really going and actually learning the science of this stuff. Even if you don't want to apply it, at least being able to speak the language. Because over the next 10, 15 years, I really think marketing is going to fully pivot over to this model of being data-driven, and you just don't want to be left behind. So if you think about marketing as becoming an art and a science, if you still only know the art, right, you're inherently going to be left behind.
Terrific. Cool. Any other questions for Alan? While we have him on stage, captive, and able to answer our questions. No? Alan, thank you so much for your presentation.